Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. Hey now, we're going to start off with some modern time rollicking fun. Then we're going to head out on the links. We're going to make one more attempt to speak with Grammy-winning artist Dove Gnore. And we're going to finish up in a malt house. No 2 days are ever the same on this show, right? We teased you a little about these first guests yesterday when we spoke with Dana Robinson of Cabot Arts. They will be performing at the Cabot Arts and Music Festival this Saturday in Cabot. Joining me now is Rose Friedman of Modern Times Theater. Rose, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, thanks for having us.
You're welcome. The other half of Modern Times Theater, Justin Lander, is there too. Justin, great to have you here as well.
Good.
Now, listeners, to ask Rose and Justin about Modern Times Theater, you can give us a call at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255, and you can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Rose, what in the world is Modern Times Theater?
Modern Times Theater is a theater company that is comprised of myself and Justin.
That's me.
We perform all over the region, usually in Vermont, a little bit in New Hampshire, sometimes venturing a little further down the coast. But we basically make our living doing shows for all kinds of audiences, mostly puppet shows, music, comedy. And we perform a lot in libraries and schools, but also at fairs and festivals, like the one that Dana was talking about yesterday. Mm-hmm. Community groups bring us a lot to perform in their old town halls or on the town green. We love doing shows where we can perform for, a whole wide swath of the community. And we like when the shows can be free. So we love libraries for that reason, because they bring us and they pay us to do our show, and then the whole audience gets to come and watch for free.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Justin, when and how did the two of you come up with this idea for Modern Times Theater?
Well, it was a bit of an evolution. Rose and I met at the Bread and Puppet Theater, and we became a couple there, and then we got married in 2007 and left the full-time company, and we made a vow to quit doing theater.
That was part of your wedding vows?
I vowed not exactly, but sort of. Okay. Put theater to the side and to take up other ventures, and little by little the theater crept in and pushed everything else out. Until we arrived where we are now, maybe 6 years ago now, seven or 8 years ago, that this has been our only job.
It only seems like 6 years.
Like 150.
I can imagine. You both have very interesting backgrounds, so I'll ask you each about it. Rose, first of all, tell us about your background before you two got together.
Well, so I think it's important to mention that Modern Times Theater, the name, actually came from my parents, who had their own version of Modern Times Theater in New York City when I was a little kid growing up there in the early 80s. So they started and founded what was a very different kind of theater. They weren't doing puppet shows, and they were, in New York City, and they were doing topical shows about issues that people in their neighborhood were facing and people around the country, and then they would tour those shows. So I grew up in that setting, as a kid of theater, so that it's a little hard for me to picture any other thing that I would do. And it's sort of why I've been trying to get away from it for my whole life also. that's my background as a theater kid, and I studied theater in college, and that's what led me eventually to Bread and Puppet. I also have a little bit of background in education, early childhood licensed, and worked a little bit as a children's librarian up in Greensboro. So So we both have a very strange sort of patched together background, and I've tried a lot of different jobs over the years.
Yeah. Rose, you can run from theater, but you cannot hide.
That's correct.
That's right. No. And Justin, how about you?
I had more or less the opposite upbringing. I grew up in a household with two scientists as parents, and the notion of making your living in the arts was like maybe worse than getting Lyme disease or something like that.
Absolutely.
Just not possible. Never do that.
I can hear that conversation. Mom, Dad, I want to do puppets.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. Oh, really? So I was always a musician, and I was the kind of kid who needed to show up at school with some props to work with. I was just always bent on entertaining, even though at the time I didn't understand that's what it was.
Yeah.
And I did the improv comedy and avoided scripts whenever possible, but I always wanted to be in front of people performing. So Bread and Puppet in that way was a great fit because you didn't have to have training, and it was loose, and you could bring whatever talents you had and sort of sharpen them in that way. And that was kind of my route in. And had I not met Rose, I probably would have gotten a normal job
and put aside my
calling. Mm-hmm. But this is unfortunately how it worked out.
Now, among other things, is this a real thing? You are a professor of Mr. Punch?
Yeah, that is
real thing.
That is how it is put. Punch and Judy shows are hundreds of years old.
Yes.
The earliest sighting of Mr. Punch, which is in England, happened about 360 years ago, and it's an official. He was performing for the king in a little garden. There's a plaque there, and they celebrate Mr. Punch's birthday every year. So, over the last 360 years, there's been thousands of professors of Punch, and it just means that you're a person who does a Punch and Judy puppet show.
But I will say that folks in England don't really recognize what we do as Punch and Judy because we have a pretty Americanized, bastardized version of their traditional form of entertainment.
Yeah.
And some people in England also do that now, too, but they are also frowned upon by the traditional professors of Punch.
Yeah.
So when you're introduced, Justin, it's like, oh, and now a professor of Mr. Punch, but we don't really like what he's doing with Punch over there.
we don't quite consider it to be the purest form of Punch and Judy.
We posted a trailer for our show a year ago, and one of these characters responded, "Looks like a great show. It's not Punch and Judy, you know."
And Rose, you know, as Justin mentioned, Punch and Judy dates back to somewhere like the 16th, 17th century. And I just want to remind you, the name of your theater is Modern Times Theater. So,
yes, thank
what's
you.
Help me now. Help me. I have a little disconnect.
Well, I think, you know, in our work, we like to focus on popular forms of entertainment and, you know, popular in theater means the stuff that appeals to the widest swath of the community as possible. So it's just kind of what everybody can get behind and agree on, which is, you know, a hard thing to find these days. So we are aiming for the laughs that can hit all the different parts of the crowd, all ages, all backgrounds, all types of people. And that's sort of what we mean by popular or populist forms of theater. So Punch and Judy is obviously a very old form of entertainment, but like so many of our classic things that we come back to again and again, our pastimes, our cultural forms, they have to be remade, made new again and again for whoever we're trying to entertain at this moment. So we tell our audience at the beginning of the show, you know, we've got some jokes in here that we're laughing at for hundreds of years.
You must really get the laughs from the crowd that is aged about 300 to 350 years old.
Yes,
when they
should,
yeah, they absolutely love the Modern Times Theater. Yep. Yeah, I can see that. Okay. Now, Justin, what is the BAFO Box Show?
The BAFO Box Show, this is a new show. So one of the things about Modern Times Theater is it's a two-person company, and we have two kids. So every time we go to do a show, it involves child care or dragging the kids along or forcing the kids to be in the show.
Oh, no.
So we started working on this new show that's a solo hand puppet show. And everything about our Punch and Judy show is about the dynamic between me, and I'm doing the puppets, and Rose, who's what's called the bottler. And she sits out front mm-hmm. and plays ukulele and is sort of narrator and straight man, and it's a whole dynamic like that. So we set out to make this new show that's a solo show, so we had to kind of refigure everything we knew. And I had several different early versions of this show, and then it had bookings, and the pandemic happened, and it just died.
Mm.
In the process of the pandemic, we applied from the Jim Henson Foundation for funding to remake the show and received it. So we spent the winter creating this totally new kind of hand puppet show. It's not a traditional show. It's not based on the form of Punch and Judy, but it's based on what hand puppets can do and what a single performer can do to hold an audience just with hand puppets. So the box is a cardboard box that is attached to my body with false arms,
mm-hmm.
and all the puppetry happens inside, or sort of comes out of the top of the box. And it's a visual illusion that allows all these kinds of puppetry tricks. The rule of thumb for hand puppetry is there should be a trick in every scene. And we try to be faithful to that in this new show.
And I think sheep make an appearance in the BAFO Box Show as well. All right, Rose, you've got Punch and Judy at Cabot Arts this Saturday. I think next Thursday it's Ruchi Tucci and the Ragtime Shepherd Kings in East Hardwick. What exactly is East Hardwick in for next Thursday with Ruchi Tucci?
I should say that, you know, part of what we do in this community and in our work is to try to bring in and produce as much entertainment as we can. So besides putting on our own shows and putting on events of all kinds, you know, community meals and bingo nights and everything else. We bring in touring performers, and we have a lot of friends who are as strange and funny as we are. And this band is a group of friends who hail from Detroit and Memphis and New Orleans, and they're just a group of completely stellar musicians. And their mission is to revive and relearn the hits of Tin Pan Alley, so that's like the
often the lesser known.
Yeah, very much lesser known.
I should have assumed that.
Tin Pan Alley. So the songs that they're playing are about 100 years old, and they are reviving them with just the most brilliant performative sense of humor. And I just, they can't be really compared to anything else. You just have to see them to believe them. And there's still a few seats left open for reservations in the beautiful Grange Hall in East Hardwick, which is a small jewel box, little space. Mm-hmm. And it's just a unique evening of entertainment, unlike anything else.
Now, Justin, will you jump up on stage with your bicycle pump to play along with them?
The last time they did a concert there, we worked out a really nice version of Home on the Range that we changed to Home on the Grange, in which Bicycle Pump did a duet with a musical saw.
Oh, nice. Now, yeah. Rose plays the ukulele, but Justin, you take things from around the house, I guess, and turn them into instruments. Am I right about this?
Yeah, I play the bicycle pump. We have a contraption we call the Garbage Matron, which is a collection of various household objects and noisemakers and things sort of arranged into a xylophone.
Mm.
I've always been interested in non-traditional sounds. I run a workshop called Junk Music and Sound Experimentation for kids and for adults. And we make some musical instruments, and we just learn to use our ears in a different way to hear music where otherwise you might hear a grating sound or a horrible noise.
We heard this morning on our news about a group, I think in Washington, D.C., playing music on typewriters, old manual typewriters. So you're right there. You're right in the trend, Justin. So
one of my dreams is to put together a chainsaw and lawnmower orchestra.
Of course. No one is surprised. Rose, what kind of community projects have you gotten involved with? Has Modern Times Theater gotten involved with?
Well, Modern Times Theater has, you know, experimented with putting on all kinds of events for a long time. And you know, one of the things we've done for some years that was happening right when COVID hit was the Saturday Storefront Puppet Show series. And we did that in Hardwick for some years, and then we had actually just tried to move it over to St. Johnsbury, and we're working with Catamount Arts there. And basically, you know, we like to take non-traditional spaces and sort of bring them to life.
Mm-hmm.
And we had taken an empty storefront first in Hardwick and then in St. Jay and sort of spruced it up and installed our little puppet theater into it and run like a trilogy of shows that were like Saturday morning cartoons live with a cliffhanger ending each week. Come back next week and find out what happens to Mr. Punch. So we love to just invent, you know, ways to put entertainment into unexpected places. But, you know, over the years, that has really become a big portion of what we do. It's like a whole arm of our company. And so we've teamed up with a couple of other folks recently, and we have a new organization called the Civic Standard, which is sort of becoming the umbrella for all of that community programming that we do. All the bringing in touring performers, the bingo nights, the community meals. At the beginning of the summer, we built like a homemade midway, carnival midway, with a bunch of high school students, and we brought that to our town fair, to the Hardwick Spring Fest.
Mm.
So we had, you know, the usual games that you would see, you know, at the Caledonia Fair or something like that, but they were all homemade. So these kinds of ways to bring theater into unexpected places, I think most people don't consider carnival entertainment necessarily traditional theater. But for us, it's, as performers, you know, we like to bring our stuff to the audience and not just sit, you know, in a big fancy theater and wait for people to buy tickets. But we like to bring it into everywhere you wouldn't expect to find it.
Justin, you both use the term non-traditional so often. It's becoming a tradition now. But, you know, how do you develop these performances that aren't based on, you know, well, I guess Punch and Judy is, but they really are so non-traditional. You have to think up new ways of entertaining. How do you go about that?
Well, we sit around and talk a lot.
Yeah.
We try to make each other laugh. You know, I have a theory about the arts, or really everything, that any good idea is fully formed within 12 minutes. So you just either have a good idea or you don't. And if you have an idea, you think that's a good idea, and you spend days, weeks, or months trying to bring it to fruition, it's probably not a good idea.
Right.
So, you know, a lot of these things, it's like a single idea. Hey, we could do a carnival midway with kids. That's a good idea. And then we try to do it. We did it 2 years ago on a small scale, and somebody saw it and liked it from the Kiwanis organization. So that's how we ended up doing that this year for Hardwick. We do things, we try them, we throw them out there, we see if they work. And if they don't work, something about it was good, and then we move on.
And, Justin, your family, they've now fully embraced your career choice. Justin, are you there?
Except that it was probably the only reasonable option. And we do, you know, the we've proved it, that it's legitimate. I will hesitate to admit I grew up in suburban New Jersey, and where we live now is so far from there.
Yep.
And the rules and everything about living here are so foreign that it's just like my parents can't really comprehend what we are and what we do, but they seem to like it.
Yeah.
So, you know, good enough.
We'll take that.
10 years ago or 20 years ago, not so much. Not so much.
Yeah. Rose, we've got about 30 seconds. What do you hope that kids and adults take from the performances of modern times theater?
Well, we love being rooted in a place where we do our shows, and we love that the shows and all the events that we put on are now sort of in conversation with our community. So, you know, we hope that folks will come to the show who've never seen it before and try something out that they're not sure about. And we also love when people come back again and again, and when they tell us what they want to see more of.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's really what we cherish about living in this place and performing, you know, for such an unlikely place from where we grew up. You know, this is, you don't usually move to Hardwick, Vermont if you want to make your living as a performer.
Too true.
But we think it's the best place in the world to make your living as a performer.
Rose Friedman and Justin Lander are Modern Times Theater. They're performing in Burlington tomorrow, Lindenville on Friday, and at the Cabot Arts and Music Festival on Saturday. And to learn more, you can visit moderntimestheater.com. Rose and Justin, thanks for being on the show this morning.
Thanks for having us, Rick.
You're welcome. Take care. We're going to take a break for CBS News, then come back to meet a Vermonter who had a special place at the recent U.S. Open in Brookline, Mass. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Did you know that Radio Vermont Group Digital Services can create videos, including drone footage? We've even won awards for our videos. If you'd like to learn more and see examples of our work, go to rvgdigital.com. Radio Vermont Group. We're more than just radio.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. In golf, there are four major tournaments: the Masters, the U.S. Open, the British Open, and the PGA Championship. When you watch them, there's something that sets them apart from the typical PGA Tour stop. One, the field is more robust, granted, and that field they're playing on is more challenging. Something about the way the course is manicured and the pins are placed. It takes quite a crew to get that course in shape, and on the crew at the Country Club in Brookline, Mass. For the recent U.S. Open was a Vermonter. That was Steve Parker. He's the golf course superintendent at Mountain View Country Club in Greensboro, and he joins us now. Steve, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning.
Good morning. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Steve about his experience at the U.S. Open, you can call us at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Steve, give us a little history of your club, the Mountain View Country Club in Greensboro.
Well, it started back in 1898. The land was leased by two farms, the Tolman Farm and the Allen Farm. And in the 1930s, the country club purchased the land from the Tolmans. And in the 1950s, they purchased the rest from the Allen Farm. It started out as three holes. They used tomato cans as cups. And it was all pasture land between the down hall and the lake. And they progressed to five holes and nine. The course still lays on this same piece of land. Now instead of bare pasture land and fences and stone walls, it's fairways lined with a lot of trees and woods. You know, now not only nine holes of golf we have here, we also have seven clay tennis courts.
Yep.
The first was put in 1908 and the second 1914, and then continued on. Now we have seven. And then within the past 2 weeks, we've just finished our putting in two brand new pickleball courts.
Oh,
so it's progressed a very long way.
Steve, no more tomato cans for the holes.
No. they wanted me to use real cups.
Well, let's talk about this. The oldest golf course in the United States is Oakhurst Links. That's in White Sulphur Springs, West Virginia. That was built in 1884. So it was only 14 years later that Mountain View, even though it was just three holes, was built. So, how did that early development happen all the way up here in Greensboro, Vermont?
Well, again, in the United States, the golf craze was happening at that time. And so they basically wanted to jump in and go ahead and do it. And there was a lady named Jane McKenzie, and she basically encouraged her friends, who built the course,
to
get it started.
Has it ever undergone any major redesigns in all that time?
You know, over the years, they changed where some of the holes were, but major, huge improvements since probably, I believe it's in the late 90s. About 1962, when they put the practice green in. The only major change that we did is in the past 25 years was redid the seventh green because of drainage purposes back there. The old green didn't have real good drainage, so they rebuilt the seventh green. But other than that, it's all in the same areas.
Well, Steve, I think you're missing one major development situation in all that time. For a long time, I believe the cows were kind of allowed in or around the course. When did they finally get shooed away from Mountain View?
Basically, it was in the 1950s, the late 1950s, I was told that they they finally did away with them. But they used to, it was an interesting, one of the local rules were, if you landed in a cow paddy, you actually had a free lift without a stroke. You were able to move it.
Oh, man. And you're hoping you had a caddy that day to lift the ball for you.
Exactly. They had the greens fenced off, and you'd have to open the gate and go in onto the green and then come back out and close the gate to make sure that the cows didn't get in there.
Oh, isn't that wild? What are some of the special characteristics to this nine-hole course?
Well, we have it's basically still on the same lay of the land, how they built it. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it's all moguls and rocks. That, you know, Vermont has many rocks, and this is full of them. So now it's just a lot of moguls. We don't have sand traps, but the undulation of the moguls and the greens are small, and yet they're hard to play. There's not really a level, except for number seven that we have that we rebuilt, and we really don't have a level green, and so it's a pretty challenging course. Even though people drive up and they look like, well, it's short, it's easy. And when they come in, a lot of times they'll say, wow, we didn't expect this.
Yeah.
But they love it.
How long have you been at Mountain View, Steve?
I've been here 8 years.
Uh-huh.
I've been the superintendent six of it. And
do you remember the first time you played it and what you shot?
I don't remember what I shot, but I'm sure it wasn't very low. But I believe it was, I have it written down here, I think it was right around 2015, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
A local lady, I actually, at that time, I had a logging business, and I was looking at her woodline. She asked me if I'd like to go up and play around the golf. And so I came up and played it. It was very intriguing back then.
Mm. How did you train to become a golf course superintendent?
Well, I was hired. One superintendent left, and another one was hired, and I was hired to work as a grounds crew with him.
Uh-huh.
And after a few years, he decided to move on to a bigger course. He's younger, with a lot of ambition, really nice, and very, very good superintendent. And he went to another course, and so I moved into that position and went to school at the University of Massachusetts. I did the winter school, and and I've been here ever since.
Nice. Now, during what months is Mountain View normally open each year?
We usually try to open between the first and second week of May, and usually close October 31st.
And the weather always cooperates here in Vermont, so you don't have to worry too much about that, right?
Sometimes in October and in May we have to wait for the snow to melt.
Yeah, and obviously Vermont has these long winters. So what kind of work must you do to the course once the club closes at the end of the year there in October?
Well, we have to, again, take care of all the leaves and things from the fall, because now we are lined with many trees, and we do that and clean up around the edges, and I put to bed the greens for the winter, and also the irrigation needs taken care of, and we do a lot of servicing of all the equipment, repairs, all that sort of thing.
And then during the winter, any activities like cross-country skiing or snowshoeing, is it allowed on the course during the off-season?
Yeah, the members are allowed to come up and cross-country ski and come up and do snowshoeing and things like that, yes.
Yeah, I'm sure that's beautiful. So when do you ramp up for the new golf season?
Well, I usually start in the last week of March, and what I didn't get finished in the late fall and in early winter of servicing the equipment, I do that. And then we go out and basically clean up any damage that the winter is giving us. And sometimes it's I've actually had to snow blow greens off.
Wow.
At the beginning, yeah, at the middle of April, I've actually had to snow blow our second green a lot of times. It had at least 2 feet or 2.5 feet of snow still on it.
Yeah. Shoveling snow, not a normal activity that you think a golf course superintendent has to worry about, but at least now you don't have fences around the greens and have to worry about the cows getting on them, right, Steve?
Exactly. Yeah.
All right. And let's go to the phones, talk to Dave in Plainfield. Good morning, Dave.
Hey, Steve. Dave McKnight in Plainfield. I'm going to get off quick because I want to hear your experience at the Open. I've played your golf course many times. Dan Hudson and I have known each other since first grade. I worked at the U.S. Open at Wingfoot in 1974.
Oh.
You may not know about it. That was called the Massacre at Wingfoot. Hale Irwin won with a score of 7 over par.
Oh, yeah.
And I also went to the winter course at UMass, probably the same that you did.
Oh, how great. Dave,
you do
thanks.
A great job up there, Steve.
Oh, thanks for sharing that. Steve, you're probably familiar with a lot of that golf history, but we want to talk about this U.S. Open. So as part of the grounds crew down there at the Country Club in Brookline, Mass., first of all, how were you chosen for this?
Well, they sent letters out to the superintendents and invited us down, being close and basically in the area. They wanted to get as many local superintendents as possible to be able to work down there, because it was going to be a once-in-a-lifetime experience for a lot of us. And so they invited us down. We had dinner, and they went over all the commitments that we would have to make. You know, we have to spend a whole week leaving our own courses, you know, a full 7 days. So they knew very well that that's a huge commitment and sacrifice for our own courses. And so we had to fully understand exactly what was going to be expected of us before we could ask if we could go ahead and do it. And it was very nice that our president, Rick Healy, was very supportive in allowing me to do this.
Steve, have you ever been part of any of the other Opens or any other tour events, or is this the first time for you?
No, this was the first time for me, and it was a very, very good experience and one I'll never forget for sure.
Yeah. Well, the eyes of the golf world are really they're upon the Open and the course where it's played. So how much pressure is on that crew that is brought in to get it just right?
Well, Dave Johnson is the director of the grounds there.
Yeah.
He was very, very, very good man, and he had a very calm demeanor. They spent four years preparing for this, and he's got a great team. And so when we came down, he just continued on with his way of teaching and encouraging. And every morning when he'd come in or at night before we'd go out, he'd say, you guys are doing a fantastic job, but we can do better. He just kept, he was like a cheerleader actually, and he knew we all knew what we were doing. We were very good at our jobs, and he put full confidence in us, and that rubbed off, and everything worked out really well.
Steve, what was your role during the week there at the Open?
I had the privilege of mowing greens. I was assigned with another assistant with one of their superintendents. They have many I was able to do number 7, number 12, and number 16 every morning. And then when we finished that, we would go around, help fluff up the rough, fluff up the fescue around the bunkers, rake the bunkers, things like that, just get it ready for the day. And then in the evening, we would mow different greens a lot of times because we would go out as the players were still there. So we would leapfrog around to different greens, and then we would fill divots in the fairway. We'd, again, get the bunkers ready and all these many different things. Whatever he asked of us, everybody just jump in and do it.
Now, Steve Parker, if I'm mowing my lawn and I scuff something up, no big deal, right? It's my lawn. We can play on. But when you're mowing a green, especially that's going to be used for the U.S. Open, this has to be perfect every single time. So what kind of things do you have to pay attention to as you're mowing a green?
Well, you have to make sure that you're within the width, your lines that you're making, and making sure that you pick up before the fringe and different things like that. And it was very hard because we weren't cutting a super lot of grass because we were mowing twice a day.
Yeah.
And double cutting and doing it twice a day. So there wasn't a lot. It was to be able to keep the greens consistent. And we would basically spray a little water on it so we knew where we were going.
Yeah. Now, do you think you've learned anything during that week down at the Open that will help you as you that you could utilize back here at Mountain View in Greensboro?
Oh, there's many ideas that I received from them. Very much networking, being able to learn how to be a better team player, and rubbing that off on hopefully our team we have here. And they do a very good job here, and we just continue to have a family-like relationship, just as down there, there was 100 of us, and we came in, and before we left, we all felt like we knew each other and rallied around each other and shared that experience and got pretty close. And that's the way I'm trying to do it here at Mountain View, keeping my crew working hard and trying to be more of a family rather than just a few workers here.
Yeah, a nice networking experience as well as what you learned, professionally. Now, golfers love those early tee times, and that means the course has to be pretty much set up and ready to go for them when they want to tee off. So let's talk a little bit about what the daily regimen is for you and your crew at Mountain View to make sure that it's ready each morning for somebody to get out there and play.
Well, we usually get here before 6, and one person will drag the fairways to get the dew off. Another will the other two will grab the mowers and do the greens and the approaches and try to get them ready for the first players that go out. And we're usually ahead of them pretty well.
Yeah. And then do you and the crew get to go out and play the course at all to kind of see how it's playing, what needs to be done?
We try to. My crew gets to play more than I do, basically. But it is. It's a great idea. I usually try to ride around or walk around during the morning to check out things to see if there's anything that's necessary for sure. There's always something to do, but it is nice to be able to play because you're seeing it as a player's view instead of a worker's view.
Right.
So we try to be able to do that.
What's your handicap, Steve?
A lot.
Okay, I won't bring that up.
No, between 16 and 18.
All right. And any tip, we had Dave from Plainfield who loves playing the course, says it's kind of difficult. Any tip for Steve on how he can shave a few strokes off his score next time he plays Mountain View?
Try to be short of the greens except for number three. Three, you want to be long.
Ah.
And keep it in the fairway.
All right.
That's about it.
Well, Steve, we really appreciate that you were able to call us this morning and be on with us. Steve Parker is the golf course superintendent at Mountain View Country Club in Greensboro. And you can learn more about the club. You can visit mvccvt.com. Steve, thank you for being on, and congratulations for being part of that U.S. Open. It was really beautiful to see that course played so well that week. I loved watching it, and I love it even more knowing you were part of it.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. We're going to take a break for a CBS News update, and then we'll hear from singer Dobe Ganore. And the Sox and the Guardians go at it. Game three of their four-game set from Fenway. Our coverage tonight commences at 6:10. First heave is at 7:10. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
We hope you're enjoying this podcast of Vermont Viewpoint with Rick Singeri. You can find podcasts of some of the other programs on our website. In addition, we also have CBS podcasts, including Sunday Morning with Jane Pauley and 60 Minutes. For a full listing of podcasts, visit our website at WDEVradio.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. And now we're going to talk about malt. We're going to flip the script here a little. As a kid, I loved malted milk balls and chocolate malts. As I got older, I enjoyed the maltiness of some beers, and I love my single malt scotches. But as I was preparing for this interview yesterday, I finally realized I have no idea what malt malting, single malt, chocolate malts, any of it is other than a flavor I could identify. Ooh, yikes. All right, so here to save the day is Rob Hunter, the malt house manager at Vermont Malt House in Charlotte. Rob, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You are Rob, right?
Yep, I'm
okay, get closer to that mic, Rob, so people can hear you. And then we also have Jamie Dragon, the head maltster at Vermont Malt House. Jamie, great to have you here as well.
Hello, thanks for having us.
All right, not sure I know what a maltster is yet, but I don't even know what malt is yet, right?
We can clarify all that.
I thought so. Okay. All right. Let's get these mic levels up a little bit so people will indeed hear you. All right. So let's start. Rob, yeah. What exactly is malt?
So malt is basically any grain can be malted, and it's the base ingredient for beers and whiskeys. And what we do is there's an entire process to making it. What we're doing is taking the basic seed that you would plant in the ground and then basically taking the sugars and making those accessible to amplified and accessible to
sounds so easy, just yeah. A little bit of science. Can you explain now, Jamie, this process of malting? Is it very complicated?
Sure. Well, it's one of those things where, you know, we've been doing it for 10,000 years, right? That's how long beer's been around. It's a very simple concept in that you soak some seeds in some water and then you germinate it and then kiln it. But there's a lot more science to it than that.
And you said kiln, not kill.
Kiln, yes, not kill. Well, actually, there is sort of a killing stage in there because the germination is growing the seed, which is what I'm trying to do. Just like you'd plant a seed in your ground. But then I need to, I guess, sort of kill it, if you want to use it, to keep the starches back into the actual seed so the brewers can crack that and get their sugars out of it.
And somebody 10,000 years ago figured this out.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yep. You know, I'm guessing that was just sort of a seed started germinating and it hit some water and some natural yeast came and that's pretty good to drink.
Yeah, right. It always happens by accident.
I don't think there's a scientist involved at that point, but
right.
We'll see.
you kind of reverse engineer it at that point, figure out what happened here, and that's what we're going to do from now on. So why exactly, Rob, do we malt the barley? Why not just, like, throw it in the vat as, you know, as it is, cook it up to make beer or spirits?
Well, essentially what you're doing is you're taking those starches and those proteins and, and the enzymes that are originally in the seed, and then you're transforming them into the sugars. And so the sugars are really what you want the brewers will crack it once it's turned into malt, and then they'll make a tea, and they soak all the sugars out of the seed and into the water, and then they discard the seed,
yeah,
and add yeast, and the yeast eats the sugar and makes it into alcohol. So that's how you
get
alcohol.
There we go. There's the process. That's the magic hour right there. Thanks to you all, right?
It's nice to be recognized every now and then, that's for sure.
Yeah, the malters never get the real, you know, it's always the brewmaster that we hear about, right? We never hear, I didn't even know there was a maltster.
Yeah, so that's sort of the thing is, one of the things we're trying to work out is, you know, malt's also in beer. Everybody knows what a citra hop is, and everybody knows what a, you know, Simcoe hop is.
Right.
But, you know, 90% of your beer is the malt flavor.
Oh, my gosh.
And without the malt, you don't have any alcohol either.
You're like the offensive lineman of the beer process.
Absolutely right. Yep. And I get whiskey. Paid like one, too.
The hop guys are the quarterbacks.
They get the quarterback money, right?
They make all the cash.
Yep, exactly.
I can't believe. This is why – now I know why. My next question, I'm not sure anyone says as a kid, Jamie, when I grow up, I'm going to be a maltster, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Nobody wants to be the guard.
Yeah,
when you
right.
go to your first flag football practice, nobody's like, I want to be an offensive guard.
Yeah, no one.
No one.
Zero. And they look at you and say, this guy's going to he's going to be a maltster when he grows up. We're going to put you in right guard. Now, that's really important.
No, those guys stay in the league for a long time, too.
Yeah.
You know?
They do. It's a good point. So maltsters have staying power. Explain how you got to be a maltster and got into this.
Well, you know, the craft malt world is pretty small. There's only like 80 in the country, and it's dominated just like the beer world by three major companies in the Midwest. You know,
malters.
Maltsters, yes. Yeah. Three malt houses. There's three major ones and a bunch of small ones. So there really isn't a way to work your way up in the world. So the previous ownership of our business, I started with that, building the actual malt house construction-wise. And the owner was like, you wanted to stay on? So I just learned on the fly from the previous owner who had taken some classes, and, you know, there is no real, you know, AAA working your way up through.
Right.
You just got to learn by doing it.
So was construction your background?
Sort of. I was a painter. I was working at a ski shop in the winters and painting houses in the summers with some other jobs thrown in there. And the ski shop was slow that winter. So he's like, I met the previous owner, and he's like, you want to help me build this barn? I was like, okay. And then it just turned into a job, and here we are.
No kidding. Rob, how about you? How did you get into this business?
Pretty much the same kind of a path. I was actually, I used to run a nonprofit organization. So I had management skills, and essentially they ended up being asked to help out kind of learned on the fly as well.
Yeah, nobody looks at a resume and says, good, he's got great malt skills. You walk into a malt house and they never let you leave is pretty much how you become a malt expert.
Yeah, I actually tried once and they dragged me back. So it was,
yep.
As a matter of fact, I think they both have like ankle bracelets on right now.
Yeah, when you try and find another employee, there isn't a lot of resumes that have malt house on experience on them. So,
oh my gosh,
clean slate, which is nice, right?
Yeah. So, listeners, if any of you have ever had a malted drink, you know, you are in line to become part of the Vermont Malt House empire. Now, Jamie, my friends and I have really become fans of the IPAs being created by Dirt Church Brewing up in East Haven, Elbows Out and their Double IPA. And it's specifically because they have this beautiful malt flavor, which you don't get a real strong malt flavor sometimes in these other IPAs. So can you tell us about what they're doing to make their beer sing, or what you're doing for them? Why is that, like, this special flavor I'm getting from Dirt Church? I'm giving you all the credit now.
Okay, I love it. I love it. Yeah. So there's a couple of things that a malter can do, and even further back that a farmer can do. You know, just like wine, you know, there's a terroir. You know, if
right,
the
right.
grain's grown in the Northeast Kingdom, where Dirt Church is, that's going to have a little bit of flavor from the Addison County area, maybe, right? So there's that part. And then from a technical side, you know, if I germinate a little bit longer than maybe traditionally, or if I kiln a little bit higher temperatures to seal those flavors in, that's going to get a little more roasty flavors and toasted, which is, you know, our goal as being a smaller malt house is I can talk directly to Anna and Bruce from Dirt Church, and if they want maybe a little bit darker roast on their Pilsner malt, I can do that for them. Whereas when they just call a commodity place, they might not be able to do that, you know?
Gotcha. So there are different ways, Rob, of malt of making malt. I mean, not all malts are exactly the same.
Sure. One of the things we've overlooked talking about is not only are you know the alcohol, all those different things, but the color of beer comes from the malt as well. And so the color comes from the different roasting techniques that Jamie's using when he's making the malt. And so, of course, there's always a sacrifice. The darker you go, tends to reduce the extraction level of sugar, so you'll have a lower alcohol. So then it becomes the art of the brewer, where they're taking all of these different colored grains or types of grains, and they're blending them together, and that's where it becomes infinitely complex.
Oh, wow, this is great stuff. Now, other than barley, what other grains do you malt?
You know, any of the cereal grains, rye and wheat particularly grow well in Vermont. So we're trying to experiment with those a little bit more. You know, triticale, all the gluten-free stuff, sorghum.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Millet. All this can really be done. We just heard for our regenerative farm, the Earthkeep Farm Common, we just heard about this grain called Kernza, which is a perennial grain. So the rootlets go way down really far, and it'll grow for 3 or 4 years. So you're not harvesting every year. So
yeah.
The carbon footprint's a little bit better and everything.
So you're
going to try it. We're going to see what happens. We got to plant some and see what happens. But
oh, my gosh. Are there any of the grains that are more persnickety than others that you know make it a little more difficult when you're in the malting process?
Well, unfortunately, barley is really the tricky one.
yeah, that's the one you do the most.
Yeah, so barley, again – not speaking as a brewer, because I'm not a brewer, but barley is 80 to 90% of all your beers. Even a wheat beer is going to be 50% barley, and that's where all your sugars are coming from. And in Vermont in particular, it's a little bit tricky. I need the protein levels to be at a certain level, and I need germination levels to be at a certain level from the farm, which makes it a little tricky here in Vermont, but we're trying to get there as well.
Yeah. Rob, I know Vermont was once the breadbasket of Vermont, but do we really have the climate for these grains? Are we starting to grow them here? Are you finding that you can source them from the local area?
Yeah, we're definitely we have great success with wheat and rye, as Jamie said. We're actually in the process of bringing in a rye crop right now. But fortunately, well, I don't know if it's fortunate or not, it's a little high moisture content, so we're waiting until the weekend, which means we're working through the weekend to bring that in. But there's different areas. You know, you have the Champlain Valley, which has you know kind of a denser clay soil, and then you have as you go south, you have maybe a little bit warmer climate. So different areas will definitely speak to growing the different grains. You have maybe more success with barley in the southern part of the state. So and that's not to say that we haven't had good success up here either. We've had growers in the past make spectacular barley crops. It's just it's a lot of paying attention to the details and having a little bit of luck with the weather.
Yeah, and you're malting for both brewers and distillers, Jamie. So is there a difference on how you malt for someone who's going to make an IPA to someone who's going to make a single malt scotch, for instance?
It
wouldn't be a single malt scotch, but let's say a bourbon.
You could do a single malt scotch in Vermont. We'd actually been talking to Silo Distillery about doing that Windsor, I guess.
Yeah.
So the Whiskey Association of America is trying to make a definition of what single malt is.
Right.
And there's a whole bunch of factors that I'm kind of flaking on right now. But it's all relatively the same. I do a base malt that we call our Pilsner malt, which you all know is a Pilsner beer.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a region in Germany. They're all named after Munich, Vienna. They're all styles of malt.
Right.
That's what I saw the most of because that's the base for most things. Distiller is essentially making a wort as a brewer would, as I assume, and then they're just distilling that out a little bit. So it's all kind of the same. And as Rob was saying, if I make darker roasts – a distiller couldn't use that because all the sugars have been cooked off. but it's all kind of roughly the same, and barley being the major one. Rye is whiskey in Vermont. It's becoming big. Look out in, you know, like a year when all these things start aging and coming back out.
Yeah.
So we have a lot of Vermont rye whiskeys coming out.
Oh, my gosh. Have you been enjoying the malt business? How long have you been in it now?
Gosh, I've been doing it not as long as Jamie, but I've been in about 4 or 5 years
okay.
at this point. And, you know, the community of brewers that we are constantly working with is and the distillers, too, they're just quality people and just completely accessible and really, really have just great conversations with them. And then you have the flip side where we also have the farmers that we're working with.
Right.
And again, you know, you can't ask for better people. So, you know, both sides of who we're working with in regards to the business that we're doing is I can't say enough good things about them.
Yeah. Now I'll pick up a beer or, you know, a whiskey and I'll say, oh yeah, that's really nice. And I might be able to tell a little bit of the character or this or that. But Jamie, if you, you know, grab, you know, a Lawson's, for instance, I think that's one you work with. You know, what do you taste and, you know, what can you tell? It's like, you know, they've used your malts in this. Does it give you hints? Does it tell you, you know, anything about, or by time it gets to the process, they've done different things. You can't really tell too much.
So again, not a knock on the hop world, but the hop world takes a lot of those flavors away a little bit.
Yeah,
so when you get into like your double and triple IPAs, you're tasting a lot of grapefruit and stuff, and that all comes from the hops, which is great. Everyone loves that. I love that.
Right.
When you get into the traditional IPAs that were, you know, sort of a more of an orange color.
Yeah.
Those have a little more roasted malts, and those are where you're picking up sort of some biscuity flavors, a little bit of grassy flavors on like your lagers, and you have a crystal malt, which is cooked, get some sugars inside. Those are a little sweeter. They have a little caramel flavor to them. They're called the crystal chocolate malt.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of chocolate in the chocolate beer. If you find yourself with a chocolate chocolate stout or a coffee stout, chances are they don't have coffee or chocolate in them. Some places use coffee, but that's just the roast of the malt, actually.
Ah, it's you guys again, the offensive guards who have done. Rob, you're located at Earthkeep Farm Common, which is the old Nordic farm.
Yep.
As you come Route 7 in Charlotte, you see that beautiful farm up on top of the hill. So tell us about this place, why it's a good place for your operation.
Well, I mean, it's a great place for our operation because we have a three-story concrete structure right on site in the middle of it to start off with. So, you know, that's where we're centered physically. As far as working with Earthkeep Farm Common, we have so many great resources there. They're doing so many experimental things. They're really, you know, trying to be great stewards of the land and educate the public on that. What's really nice also is that we have 380 tillable acres. So, you know, I think we're bringing in about 60 acres of rye right now. We're planting 98 acres of wheat. We have a field that's got 20 acres of barley that, you know, we can do experimental crops. We can do a bunch of different things on site that that we wouldn't otherwise be able to.
And what's that crop we should be looking out for that could wind up in some of our drinks?
Mostly right now it would be a rye, probably. A lot of ryes are coming into some whiskeys and stuff in like a year.
Yeah,
you're talking about the Kernza, though.
The Kernza.
We've heard rye before.
Yeah, we're just sort of we're still experimenting with that. Like I'm still doing research and finding papers, and there isn't a lot on it. So whoever does it, it'll be brand new,
way out in front. Way. What goes on there at Earthkeep Farm Common on Thursdays?
Yeah, so on Thursday, all the members of the collective there, which is a shrimp farm, there's a bakery, there's a brewery. They all come together for a farm night, it's called, and everybody gets together, and the community of Charlotte and neighbors come down, and it's just like a little fun farmer's market that's there.
Yeah, and he's not making it up. There is an actual shrimp farm. Shrimp is being raised there at Earthkeep Farm Common. A fellow from over in Colchester used to have oysters down on the bay somewhere off of the Mass Coast, is now raising shrimp there at Earthkeep Farm Common. And some of you might know it as the old Dirt Church. Nordic Farm. I've mentioned Dirt Church. Who are the other brewers who are making use of what you're doing?
Gosh, the list keeps getting longer, which is fantastic.
Good to hear.
We work Foam has been a long-time partner. Hired Hand out down in Virgin's, fantastic stuff. We work with Lawson's. They're Brave Little State, 100% our malt. And with foam, they do a 4U, which is at 100% our malt. We just started working with 14th Star, so they've got some new things. They've actually been utilizing our logo to mark up, you know, what beer that they're going to be doing. A lot of local pails that are coming out are using our grains. Who else? Two Heroes.
Two Heroes, and I always think of the brewery world, but yes, there's a handful of distillers in that world as well.
Sure. I mentioned one down at Bennington.
Yep, Village Garage Silo in Bennington. We do Silo in Windsor.
AppGap.
AppGap in Middlebury.
Oh, yeah. Yep. Good.
And I think there's another one, but I can't think of it right now.
Oh, fantastic. I think you might have mentioned Mad River Valley. Or Mad River, are they with you yet? Or
Mad River bought some smoked grains from us, which that actually might be out pretty soon. So I'd look out for that too. Mm. Yep.
Oh,
we actually
it.
Have a you go to our website, www.vermontmalthouse.com,
yep,
all spelled out. There's actually a continuous growing list of brewers and with hyperlinks to their websites that we're working with.
Whirligig up in the Northeast Kingdom as well.
Yeah.
He's a super small brewery, so he's 100% with us, and he's
St.
experimental.
John's.
Yep, St. John's Very. He's very small and experimental, which is great.
He is doing a lot of canned stuff too, and all that has our grains.
Yeah,
in it,
I've been there. I'm having his wife on next week to talk about what's happening in St. John's.
All right.
Rob Hunter, Malt House Manager, Jamie Dragon, Head Maltster at Vermont Malt House in Charlotte. To learn more, you can go to VermontMalthouse.com. Jamie, Rob, thanks for being on the show this morning.
It's been great. Thanks.
Thanks for having us.
All right. We're going to take a break, and then we will come back. And this time, I promise, we will have Dobe on with her music from the Côte d'Ivoire. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
In decades past, you opened a business, hung out your shingle, and the customers came. Today, hanging out your shingle means creating an engaging website. The modern consumer is using the internet to find businesses like yours. Are you positioned so you'll rise to the top of their search? Let the Radio Vermont Group Digital Services work with you to make sure you're visible online and to target your marketing to location, demographic, and interest. Learn more at rvgdigital.com.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. When you're on the road, there's no telling what might happen. On Monday, I was hoping to have my next guest on, but her hotel room phone was placed on Do Not Disturb by the previous guest. Even the hotel staff could not undisturb it. But Grammy-winning singer Dobe Ganore has traveled all the way from Côte d'Ivoire to put on 4 shows in our area and to be on this show, so we had to try again. Dobe, are you there?
Yeah.
Good morning.
Hello.
Hello.
Morning.
Now, please, you're going to have to pardon my French pronunciations. Do I even have your name pronounced right? How do you pronounce your name?
Is Niaore.
Niaore. Dobe Niaore.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. Great. Well, welcome to the show. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, too.
Dobe will be performing tonight at the Middlesex Bandstand, which is next to the Rumney School in Middlesex, and then tomorrow night at Feast and Field Market, that's in Barnard. Dobe, you sing, you dance beautifully, you play instruments. Were you a singer or a dancer or a musician first?
I'm artist.
Artist, yes.
Yeah, artist, because when the place where I grew up it was the place of artist place, and we learned everything. And for me, to be artist, I need to know everything, every art I want to do. Dancing, playing music, compose, writing, everything. For me, everything is artist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. And do you prefer? Do you have a preference? Is there one thing you enjoy more than the other?
Excursion. I don't know.
That's all right.
I think I have two preferences. I have dancing and singing.
Yeah. Yeah, which you do beautifully. Yeah. And the performances you give, the songs are beautiful, but the dancing that accompanies them are just absolutely exquisite. We heard Redemption. Tell us about the song, the lyrics of Redemption.
The Redemption talk about of my relation with my God, with my spirit, with my prayer every day. And Redemption, I ask to my God me redonner une nouvelle vie, me come to give me the new life, come to give me the new chance for another life for me.
Inspiration. Asking forgiveness.
And, yeah, it's my relation with my God.
Yeah. And, you know, we talked about you being an artist. You grew up in a very artistic family. Tell us about your father and your sister.
Yeah, my father is a comedian and a percussionist, maître percussionist, teacher of percussionist.
Master of percussion.
Yeah, master. Percussion. And in Ivory Coast, he's very famous. He is my... My example for come to be artist too, and my father was and collaborateur
for
a big place. His name is Village Key Mbok. This place is place for artist place. Every artist from every part of Africa come here to learn and to do the artist together. And my little brother is artist too, singer. He fait le rap.
He's a rapper.
And very 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 famous in Ivory Coast. And all my family. My grandmother was singer. For dead people, when people died in my funerals, in my traditional, she sing for the people died. So, in my family, we are artists in long generation.
Absolutely. Now, I'm embarrassed to say that other than knowing that your national men's football team are known as the Elephants, I don't know much about your country. So what can you tell us about Côte d'Ivoire?
Côte d'Ivoire is a beautiful country. and we have 76 languages, and we speak French. La société speak in French because of the colonization. And we have the Jula, Baoulé, and Bété, the three language more people speak. And we have a lot traditional. We have the traditional du Nord who inspire of Malinké, Bambara. And we have the traditional qui est plus crew, inspired of
from the south,
inspiré de Nigeria, du Ghana. The my country is very mixed population.
Yep.
And And we are a lot of singer, a lot of cultural dancing. We dance a lot in Ivory Coast. Urban dance and traditional dance too.
Mm-hmm.
We have many singer, traditional and urban too. We have DJ Drogba, very famous footballer. We have Alpha Brownie, Kenja Pakoli. And a lot. My country is very, very, very beautiful.
Yeah. And you've been living in France for a number of years now. Do you get back to Côte d'Ivoire very often?
Yeah, every 3 months I go back. When I'm not, especially when is the quand l'hiver,
winter, during winter.
Yeah, right. When the winter come to Europe, I go back for the sun.
Absolutely.
But every 3 months I go back because I need to return every time for connect with my country, connect with my tradition.
Mm. We're going to play another of your songs, Nadre. Tell us about that.
Every time, yeah.
All right. Can you tell us about the song we'll play next, which is Nadre?
Nadre. Nadre is Nadre. My heart. Nadre, this song, I sung in Bété language, my language. And Nadre talk about of love, impossible love. This song is composed by Lukwa Kanza, very famous singer from Congo. And Nadre, for me, I wanted to put this song with Lukwa Kanza because it was important for me to some people and other people do the song for me. Parce que quand moi je compose mes chansons, je ne sais pas vraiment comment exploiter ma voix. Et Lukwa Kanza, lui, il...
As a guide, right? To use him as a guide.
Yeah, il a su exploiter ma voix dans cette chanson.
Okay. You can say that in English. Il a servi de guide pour t'inspirer. He serves that.
Yeah, you know how I can do my voice better. And Lukwa Kanza know me. When I compose myself, it's difficult to explain my voice very good.
Mm-hmm.
And when I work with some people another, he can't. And Lukwa Kanza do it for Nadre for this song for me.
All right. We're going to hear that. Nadre, speaking with Dobe Ngiore about her music, her dance, and her local performances. As I mentioned, she'll be performing tonight at the Middlesex Bandstand, tomorrow at the Feast and Field Market at Barn Arts in Barnard. Here is Nadre by Dobe.
Tre o bongania na te anka eri munali ba o mina male anka peti peto feto mani ani mani ani na polo. Batoculo, oh, na tre o palia un caire un ca che so, na uruma che manule, na e grani gigi, elia urumi, ne quena gi.
tu vois, vois ça où tu vois, ils sont là à parler, tu vois, ils sont là assis là-haut, tu vois. On rencontre du monde sur nos routes, on ne sait pas ce qui on va tomber, des gens qui croient en toi.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. Friday, I was burning up my email. I was texting friends saying, you need to listen to this music. Dobe Nyore is a Grammy-winning artist, an amazing dancer, and is in our area for two more performances. She appears tonight in Middlesex at the Bandstand, which is right next to the Rumney School, and then tomorrow in Barnard at the Feast and Field Market. Dobe is with me for a few more minutes to share her story and her music. Dobe, tell us about the song we just listened to.
This song talk about people who need to, comment dire, t'accompagner pour donner de bons conseils dans la vie. Il faut s'entourer, en fait. Il faut s'entourer des bonnes personnes.
To get a guy to give you the right way of going.
Yeah.
To live your life. To live your life.
S'entourer des bonnes personnes et vivre ta vie. Sans te préoccuper des mauvaises énergies, vraiment avancer, quoi.
Surround yourself with the right people.
Yeah.
Be positive for everything.
Your song's not only beautiful musically and have this wonderful Afro-pop beat, but the messages in the lyrics, even though I don't understand French, I would look for the translations, and they really do have this very uplifting, positive message in the lyrics you write.
Yeah, for me, it's important to be positive every day, every time. I try to be negative, but it's not good for me. and when I need to write positive attitude every time, I need to inspire people for the good attitude. And when I with my daughters, I need to give her the good positivity every day. And for me, it's very important. That's why I write to positivity. I write for the nature. I write for the God. I write for the good things for me and for people.
Mm-hmm. You're currently on a tour. It started in February. It's taken you through France, the UK, Germany. You were in Canada, now the United States. Do you enjoy being out on the road performing for, you know, this long time of 6 and 7 months?
Yeah, for me, if I don't play, if I don't travel, if I don't see the people, I'm like, I'm dead.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it's very important for comment diffuse my music and see the people. And when I travel, I'm still inspired for writing. Very important to travel, to do my music everywhere.
You had a couple shows over in New Hampshire. Hello. Now you're in Vermont. Have you ever been to this part of the United States before?
No, it's my first time.
What have been your impressions? What have you seen?
It's very sweet, very kind, very opening to know the new things from everywhere. Les gens sont vraiment open pour écouter et découvrir notre musique, open mind.
Mm. Very open-minded with the music, very accepting of the music you play. Are you traveling with a full set of musicians and dancers? How many are with you?
Sorry, can you confirm?
Yeah, I have my sound engineer, Eric, with me now.
Mm-hmm.
I have my bass player, my drummer, and my guitar player, and my manager, my producer. We are 5 on the tour.
Nice. Now, as I mentioned, we've been playing your music. What people can't see is your beautiful dancing, this talent you have for dance. Where did you develop that? When did that, you know, become part of you?
La danse, comment c'est devenu?
Allô?
Yeah, you're dancing, Dobe. When did you really develop this beautiful dancing that you have?
My dancing, I beginning for dance before the singing. And I beginning my dancing in, I request Abidjan with the band Village Key. And little by little, I do the different style of dancing, mm-hmm. Saba from Senegal, South Africa dance, contemporary. I mix every dancing, and I like very much the dance with the energy, with like men. When I dance, I like feel my very the dance. Yes, is my first love.
Now, in 2010, you won a Grammy for the song Pearls. How special was it to receive that award?
It was the la notoriété.
Notoriety.
Mm-hmm.
And self, pour moi-même, ça m'a permis de comprendre que la voix dans laquelle j'ai choisi, ma voix musicale dans laquelle j'ai choisi, est la bonne pour moi et peut me récompenser pour d'autres choses.
Okay. She's saying it confirmed her. To her, that it was she was on the right track, so to speak, in mm-hmm. in her creative process.
Beautiful. Dobe Gnore is an incredible singer, musician, dancer, and songwriter from Côte d'Ivoire, who has performances tonight and tomorrow here in Vermont. You can visit her website, dobegnore.com, to learn more. Dobe, it was an honor for you to be on the show, for us to have you on the show this morning. I want to thank you. I also want to thank Eric, your tour manager, for helping with the translations.
Thank you.
Merci. We're going to finish. We're going to listen to another song of yours, my favorite of yours, Bara, on the way out. So I hope you'll be performing that this evening. Thanks so much. All right. This is we're going to hear Bara from Dobe. And the show today was directed by Lee Cattell. And you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at WDEVradio.com. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here tomorrow when we talk with Sarah Middleman of the Vermont Arts Council. We learn about the future of our forests, and we visit Kiss the Cow Farm in Barnard. Siri faso ye legi 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 Sigi kuson, siri kika bogono la kuson, on kabara al nijigi ya kamus.